Lou Elizondo has helped change the world, and I know this is falls short of what we would call disclosure, that there are still secrets being kept. But I think we know a heck of a lot more than we did a couple of months ago. We know, number one, that there was a secret Pentagon UFO study program that went on for at least 10 years that appears to, in all likelihood, still be underway in some capacity. We know that they studied some pretty dramatic cases, that they have released at least a couple of videos with more on the way. We know they took it seriously, that they identified some of these things as being from somewhere else, not Earth technology, at least not known Earth technology. They don't believe it is a foreign adversary that has this. They believe that it has it relies on some kind of propulsion system and has capabilities that we do not have, that it includes special materials. All of that stuff has been made public and confirmed by these releases. Do we want to know more? Of course. Is there more coming? I hope so. We'll find out in just a moment as we continue our conversation with Lou Elizondo right here on Coast to Coast AM. Lou Elizondo, let's talk a little bit about the decision to allow the release of this information. You didn't make that on your own. Somebody higher up than you had to say it's okay to release the name of the program, for example, right?
Right. So, well, the name of the program was never classified. And so, you know, that was actually written later on after the legislation and multiple briefings up to senior DOD leadership and again back up to Congress. But you're right. So I think that's one of the mischaracterizations that probably has a lot of people confused about the videos and how they came out. And if I may, Mr. Knapp, I would like just for your audience to kind of very briefly go through the DOD process of how these things work. So,
okay.
In essence, let's take the videos for example. There's a collective decision within the office that these videos should be placed on a community of interest, unclassified community of interest, with defense industry partners and anybody and everybody to look at and figure out if this is something that they've seen before. So basically, there's an approval process that goes through the Defense Office of Pre-Publication and Security Review. We refer to it as DOPSR. That is the one-stop shop for the release of information. It has to be reviewed to make sure it's no longer classified. And there's an internal mechanism within that office where they go back to the original classification authority and validate whether or not that information is indeed classified, and if it is it still classified, and should it be released? There are, as you can imagine, with an organization like DOD, there's lots of policies they have to follow, but the two policies in particular are the DOD directives and instructions. In this particular case, DOD directive 5230.09 and DOD instruction 5230.29. In there, it gives you the, if you will, the prescription of what you are supposed to do to get information released, and to include, by the way, Department of Defense Form 1910, which was indeed executed for the purposes of creating a community of interest for these videos. So that process was followed, and what most people aren't aware of, there were also emails. So it wasn't just a form that was submitted, and a week later, DOD officially came back and said this is allowed to come, these videos are allowed to go out for unrestricted release.
I guess what I'm getting at, Lou, is this. Is there a policy decision at some level where somebody higher up said, let's see what happens. Let's go with this stuff.
That conversation never occurred with me. It was very administrative in nature. I suspect that is the case, but no one sat down with me and said, Lou, we're ready to go full open kimono with this. That discussion never occurred. I didn't have any resistance as an office to do that with the people that were aware of what we were doing and of our office, the existence of our office. But keep in mind, as you said in the beginning of your program, not everybody in our chain was necessarily privy to what we were doing. So
was there blowback for you,
yes,
pushback? Absolutely. You stand on that stage, and it came as a big surprise, right?
Yeah, for those who weren't aware of our program, yes, there was tremendous surprise, and more importantly, I think there was initially some anger. Well, I know there was. Um, to this day, some individuals within the department have mischaracterized a little bit about how these videos came out. First of all, I never released them. We never released them as an office to the media. They're saying, oh, Lou released them to the media. I did not. That never happened. So how the New York Times obtained their copies of the videos, you would have to go to the New York Times and ask them, but it did not come from me. So that's first and foremost. And then as far as these individuals who were aware of our program, they didn't have any issue with this information coming out because, again, the intent was to create a community of interest that this information was going to come out anyways, and people would have a chance to look at it and see if any of these signatures, these things that we're seeing, someone else has also captured.
I guess what I mean is if somebody wanted to stop it, no, we can't release it, then we would not have seen those videos. So
absolutely.
Somebody had to decide, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. If someone wanted to stop it, it would have been stopped. Absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit. We'll come back to Tic Tac and Gimbal, but talk about BASS, the Bigelow Organization. I think the only person that gets more lumps online from UFO people than Tom DeLonge is Bob Bigelow, who supposedly owns this program and everything in ufology. You had a different relationship with him and with BASS. Talk about that, how it worked, because when you started, you didn't have BASS, the contractor, to do the work that they did, and now the program, assuming it's still continuing, does not have BASS either. So talk about that.
Well, look, I'm a little bit biased. I think, frankly, if you ask me, I think Mr. Bigelow's a hero. I think this is a man who risked almost everything to do something that he thought we needed to do as a country. And by the way, I feel the same way respectfully about Senator Harry Reid and Inouye and Stevens and John Glenn. These folks are, some people say, oh, they're mavericks. Well, no, I call them patriots. I think that's exactly what leadership does in this country. When they see a potential threat, they go ahead and they address it, and they're not afraid to call a spade a spade. So in this particular case, I think it's very, very important that what Bob did be recognized as something that was heroic. I really believe so. I think he put a lot on the line. So again, I'm a little biased, but what do I think about what they did in BASS collectively? I think they helped us advance our understanding of the phenomena and what we were seeing. Keeping in mind, it was a bit of a shotgun approach because you don't know what you don't know. So you kind of look at everything and anything you see. And then hopefully as you collect more and more data, you can kind of weed out that information, which is really not very relevant, if you will, the white noise, and then, kind of focus on the details of what you're trying to find. And in this particular case, I honestly can tell you we would not have come to where we are today if it wasn't for BASS. We now, for the first time in the last year and a half, believe we, inside the program, have a collective understanding. The two things I said initially we were trying to focus on. One was, what is it? The second is, how does it work? Well, sadly, we're not probably very much closer to figuring out what it is. But ironically enough, we are a heck of a lot closer to really understanding the physics and the principles of flight than we ever had been before. In fact, I think we finally may have cracked the code collectively on how this thing works. So that's huge, and we wouldn't have gotten to this point had it not been for the monumental effort that BASS put into this in the early days. I can tell you unequivocally, we would not be here if it wasn't for the efforts of BASS.
All right, you've got an understanding of how they work, based in part on these videos that have been seen all over the world and analyzed. Tic Tac, the USS Nimitz incident from 2004. When To the Stars kicks this thing off, they post a photo, and I made the same mistake when I first reported on the Tic Tac. We had been talking about it for like 2 years on this program with Jeremy Corbell before the announcement's made, but on that stage where you stood, they had this big sort of phallic balloon-looking thing that was taken from the original article, and people just can't get over that mistake was made. But it was a mistake, right?
It was a mistake. No, it was deliberate because we were encouraging people to go online. We were quoting information from the web, and it would be disingenuous of us if we were to put any picture other than what was on the web. We knew inherently that picture. We weren't telling people that was the actual Tic Tac. We were simply saying, look, this is a photo that came along that was part of that article. Now, we had the video. We knew what the Tic Tac video was, but it wasn't. We hadn't done the proper analysis yet to provide that. And I think it's important that the audience understand, we, in order to preserve the information that we were trying to relay on that stage, we wanted to basically keep to what was already available in the open press. We weren't telling people, hey, this is the Tic Tac. What we were trying to do, and maybe we fell short a little bit of what we were trying to accomplish, but we were trying to encourage people to get online and read the story for themselves so they can start asking the hard questions themselves. This is a fundamental challenge that we continue to have and that I continue to have. People say, well, why should we believe you, Lou? I don't want you to believe me. I want you to ask for the data so you can look at the data yourself and you then can formulate your own beliefs. I don't want people to say, oh, we should all believe what Lou Elizondo has to say. No, what I want you to do is go out, ask your leadership in office to request the information from the sources, provide that information, whatever they can at the unclassified level, and let people make their decisions. And the purpose of the Nimitz incident, that was the only story that was really out there in the unclassified realm that we could have a collective discussion about and that could get people starting the conversation once and for all. And I think we hit the mark with that. Unfortunately, I think we got a little bit lost in translation. When we threw up that picture, I think people probably thought that we were trying to say this is the actual Tic Tac, when in fact we knew it wasn't.
But the Tic Tac video, there had been a piece of that online that had been leaked. And it looks like it's the same video that you guys put out. Is it? Is it the same?
Could be. I don't know, because I don't analyze the videos that are online. All right. I know is that the Tic Tac video that came out, that is the official DOD Tic Tac. That was in possession of DOD. That was on a DOD system, albeit unclassified, but the system itself was very classified. So that video was preserved in DOD archives. I can't comment what's online. I don't know what people have done with videos. Sometimes videos, as you know, have been doctored. But the reason why these videos came out, because these were not. These are the actual videos. I think it's also important with the Tic Tac video that everybody understands. That video was taken by two additional F-18s that were launched right after Commander Fravor and Commander Slate had recovered back onto the Nimitz. So it's a very compelling, I think if you were to talk to Commander Fravor, he's got a really incredible story to tell. But keeping in mind, it's not just Commander Fravor's story.
Well, what I was told is that once Bass got involved and dug into those files, they had interviewed as many as 18 people who were involved at one degree or another. What does the data tell you about that technology? Why does it stand out? Why do we know it's not ours?
Well, because it's first of all, you're looking at the five observables we continue to see over and over again. And what we're seeing with the Nimitz was explained decades before the Nimitz incident. So if a foreign country has that technology, they've had it for a really, really, really long time, and we're just now beginning to understand the physics behind it to make something like that operate. So you're looking at something that does, you know, basically extreme maneuverability, well beyond the healthy G-forces of anything biological to withstand inside. You're looking at hypersonic velocities. There's very few aircraft right now that we have that we are even aware of that can even achieve those speeds, let alone the low observability, let alone potentially transmedium travel, and of course, positive lift, or, you know, some have said in the vernacular, anti-gravity. These are, one of these exotic technologies would be a game changer, would be a paradigm shift for any country, let alone a vehicle that can do all of that. I think if you look at the videos, there's a lot of more detail there than people are giving credit. You know, a recent article came out in one of the magazines, I won't say which one,
yeah.
I don't think that the writer really appreciated what they were looking at. I think if they were, you know, truly an investigative journalist, they would have done some investigation into this and not relied on a single source for their report. But those videos tell a lot. And I think when you hear the pilot saying, you know, there's a whole fleet of them, again, guys, if there was a whole fleet of adversarial aircraft, advanced adversarial aircraft, basically tilting at a 90-degree angle at 25,000 feet in a 120-knot headwind without losing altitude and hovering there, Houston, we got a problem. So there's a lot of stuff on these videos, I think, that are very, very compelling. And by the way, it's not just two videos. People say, oh, it's only just two videos. No, it's not. Those are the only two videos that got released. There are multitudes of videos that are as compelling, if not even more compelling, that remain, unfortunately, sensitive.
Well, I guess that's the big question that people have. The frustration that gets expressed is, when do we get to see them? When is it coming?
Well, I can't answer that, and they may never see the light of day. I suspect eventually they will. In time, everything eventually comes out in the wash, right? But I think, keep in mind, the Department of Defense is very cautious. It has to maintain its credibility. I totally understand it. And the last thing you want to do is put something out that turns out to be, something very, very explainable. I will tell you, these videos were scrutinized by the best of the best. But it doesn't mean that we're not wrong sometimes. But in this particular case, all the telemetry, all the radar data, everything was looked at. And it wasn't just looked over in a cursory manner. It was really, really screwed. A lot of time, attention, money, resources, and talent went into looking at these videos.
Dave Fravor's account, Lou, and Dave Fravor and maybe other witnesses' accounts, there was something really big in the water. And it seems to have gone over the heads of anybody who's reported on this, something the size of a 747 in the water, as if these Tic Tac objects were docking with it. That's pretty big. That's a pretty big story.
And again, there's some synergies there that, I think when it all comes out, people are going to really, really appreciate this a lot more. But yes, there are some congruencies that we are seeing time and time again with these phenomena associated with water, and something in the water. The water begins to roil, and the water begins to get perturbed, and that there is something potentially under the water. Now, there are several hypotheses that are out there that we looked at. It may not be necessarily something in the water, but it might be something in the water, or it might be the fact that it's an artifact, if you will, of the potentially the advanced propulsion unit, or the field, if you will, that excites the molecules in the water and causes the water to do what it's doing. We're not entirely sure. We have some pretty good ideas of what it could be. But in the end, look, the bottom line is we need more data. We need more data. We need more data. We need more data. And we need to make sure that an effort like this is truly funded the way it should be. People say, oh, $22 million was a waste of money. No, it wasn't. In fact, if you ask me, that's paltry. You know, we spent money on things far much more with, I think, much less bang for our buck. I think I read one report where we had spent something like $19 or $22 million on studying the effects of golf equipment in space. I mean, something ludicrous. Here it is. We have something that potentially could be a clear and present danger that's being reported by the best of the best. Let me ask you this, Mr. Knapp. When you take a metro or you get into an airport, you see signs everywhere that say, see something, say something. You see something suspicious, you report it, right?
Right.
And when you do, we get an attaboy and a pat on the back, even if it's someone's purse that they forgot. Guess what? You are supposed to report it. Now, here is a pilot or pilots with top secret clearances being paid and trusted to fly live munitions, sometimes over U.S. cities, and fight wars and win those wars on our behalf. And yet when they tell you they see something suspicious, they get ridiculed. They're not supposed to report it. That, to me, is fundamentally even more of a threat than any potential threat itself. The fact that we can't even report what we are seeing and what we're picking up and being backed up on electro-optical data and radar returns, the fact that we do not even have the ability to report that up through the chain of command, that is more of a national security threat than anything flying in our skies. And that has to be fixed.
We're talking about Lou Elizondo. When we come back, talk about a little bit about To the Stars, where things go from here, as well as about the Gimbal UFO video, the other one that was made public. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast. We're talking with Lou Elizondo about the ATIP UFO study that the Pentagon ran for a period, and and still may be operating in some capacity, still need to talk about these mysterious metamaterials that were discussed in a couple of the articles written about the BASS study, the BASS part of the ATIP study. Also, the technology, how does it work? What's the concept? And could it be us from the future as opposed to aliens that are operating this? I hope we can get to all of that. Much more to come in our final segment of Coast to Coast with Lou Elizondo. Lou Elizondo, you've seen the reports. You've been asked the question about the metamaterials, the exotic materials that were reportedly studied by the folks at BASS. Hal Putoff told me as much last month when he was on this program that this material didn't know who made it, but it had unusual properties. I just wonder if you can address, did it exist, how we got it, and is the material essential to how these things operated, do you think?
So, yes, it exists. Yes, other materials exist as well. And as far as the unique attributes of the material, I think, let me put this in general terms, I think anytime you have material that has the ability to display unique characteristics that do things that other materials don't do, then it's something you want to look at. In this particular case, without going into a lot of detail, I have to be obviously cognizant of the limitations here, my left and right limits. I cannot tell you what the government has in its possession. I'm not at liberty to discuss that. You would have to ask the government to answer that question for you. What I can tell you, because you're asking from a BASS perspective, that material does exist that have very, Mr. Putoff had indicated, very unique signatures, isotopic ratios that are very, very unique, that would be exceedingly difficult and expensive, cost prohibitive to manufacture, and are not found naturally here on this planet. And that material was analyzed. It's not, hey, I found a rock on the ground and, you know, this rock looks interesting to me and it glitters. That's not at all what we're talking about. We're talking about material that potentially has isotopic ratios that are extraordinarily rare and unique and appear to be engineered, manufactured in a very precise manner. And when that material is subject to certain things, certain stimulus, then it reacts a certain way. And so I think, you know, when people say, well, you know, some metal alloy that's unknown, I would like to clear the air, because I think people have confused the lay interpretation of metamaterial with metal alloy. I think when the article first came out in the New York Times, which, by the way, again, we didn't tell them metal alloy, but I think what happened is that someone probably thought it'd be easier to understand by saying a metal alloy. What we had initially indicated concerning the BASS contract is that everybody talks about the facilities, and from a government perspective, those facilities were to be built to house any and all material associated with our effort. And material, by the way, includes reports. It includes anything and everything you can conceive. And hypothetically, if material were to be recovered, actual physical material, you would want that to be preserved and secured as well in a facility that was secure. So in this particular case, I think when the story came out, they were trying to figure out specifically, it kind of got lost in communication, because those facilities were built to hold anything and everything, to include, yes, even a metal alloy if we had a metal alloy. But that got kind of watered down, and then the metamaterial discussion was kind of convoluted and confused with the metal alloy. So the bottom line is, no, we're not talking about an unknown metal alloy, because as someone has said before, any second year metallurgist can tell you there's no such thing. You can figure out what a metal is pretty quickly. It's not a new element. But we are talking about a metamaterial potentially that isotopic ratios are so unique that the origins of that material still remain unknown.
I want that to sink in for people listening who are wondering, you know, what you're saying here. That should be pretty clear. That material We don't know how to make it, and we're not exactly sure where it was made, but it has unusual properties that are related to how these craft operate. That gimbal video looks like something that comes out of the future. You know, Hal Puthoff had said it seems to be able to control space-time. I suppose it could be alien or extraterrestrial or from some other dimension or from the future. It could be us. You don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Mr. Knapp. You know, as I've said to some of my colleagues before in the past, you know, when they come into the program, they say, well, you know, is it from out there? And my response is typically, look, I don't know if it's from outer space, inner space, or the space in between. We really don't know. There's so much to this universe. And, you know, you learn in high school physics that two things can't occupy the same space at the same time, which is fundamentally true until you get to the quantum level. And then we realize, well, that's out the window. That's not necessarily true. So there's a lot of fundamental principles that we assumed for a very long time through Einstein's, obviously, relativity, only now to find through quantum mechanics. Relativity is still correct, and those basic equations are still correct, but there are some nuances to some of these theories that that allow us to look at things a little bit differently. We now know where before the famous equation E equals mc squared that you can warp space-time with a lot of mass. We also know that you can warp space-time with a lot of energy. We have now seen at the CERN, the Large Hadron Collider, experiments where we are approaching the energy levels necessary to warp space-time. You hear this conversation a couple years ago where everybody was a bit frightened that the CERN was going to start creating these micro black holes based upon the energy levels that were being generated there. And really all they're saying is, look, you know, we're at a point now where we're creating, you know, we're warping space-time at the micro level. So if that is the case, and we know that we have demonstrated that is in fact possible and we can do it, then the question is no longer can we do it, it's just a scalability question, which in time and given enough time and technology, of course, you know, we should be able to scale anything up to suit our needs at the macro level. So the question of whether it's possible or not is no longer a question. We know it's possible. We've demonstrated it. Now the question is, okay, well, what is the technology we would need to scale it to something usable?
Let me ask you this, Lou. One focus of BASS was Skinwalker Ranch. I know that Bob Bigelow had a team from NIDS on the property for years that he financed. And then after the contract was awarded, there were specialists and investigators associated with this program that were sent there. Are you in on that? Did you have a look at any of the material from there? And I ask it in this context. We're discussing this phenomena in technological terms, whereas at the ranch and in other places around the country, there are other aspects of this that get pretty weird.
Sure. Well, you know, that's a great question, Mr. Knapp, when you say weird. So let me run a real quick exercise with you and your audience. It'll only be 40 seconds, but just follow me with this for a second, if you will. When I say the word to you, parachute, what do you think of? Normally, you think of a life-saving device that slows your descent and keeps you from hitting the ground at terminal velocity.
Right.
Something good. If I say paramedic, what do you think of?
Well, the same thing, emergency technician coming to save you.
Right. Something good, right? Now, all of a sudden, if I say paranormal, whoa, wait a minute. There's a little bit of a hesitation. Maybe some people kind of hold their breath for a second. They might even crack a smile. The reason why they do that is because of social stigma associated with the term paranormal. Okay, so paranormal is nothing more than, by definition, something that is below the threshold of our understanding at this point. So by definition, as a scientist, everything, technically, everything is paranormal until it becomes normal. The phone I'm talking to you on right now, 50 years ago, this was paranormal. The cell phone that everybody uses right now in GPS, even 15 years ago, was considered paranormal and is now normal. So I think part of the problem when we had this discussion, people don't want to have it because of the social stigma that's been assigned to the term paranormal. But keeping in mind, as a scientist, again, everything is normal until it's normal. Now, if you want to take this conversation to even a more concrete level, most Americans have some belief in something. You know, so on Sunday you have half of America goes to church, and you know they pray to God. Sometimes it's on a Friday, depending if you're Jewish or whatever you know denomination you may be. But in the end, they go to church. People go to church, and we seek either assistance or guidance or protection from the divine. Now, by definition, God is supernatural. So people, I find it interesting that people are willing to put faith in the supernatural every week and in every day, and in fact pay part of their monthly salary to the supernatural. And I'm not, by the way, I'm not against God. I'm just simply stating what it is. I happen to be spiritual myself, but we place faith in things like God, the supernatural, and yet when we are faced with something like this, or someone decides to explore other areas of the quote-unquote supernatural or paranormal, people kind of raise their eyebrow and they kind of snicker. So when Mr. Bigelow and Bass are looking at things like the ranch, why wouldn't you? Look, this is a huge universe. You know, we look at things all the time. You know, 100 years ago, or two, even shoot, less than that probably, when the earth would shake and tremble, there were cultures out there that would think that Mother Earth was angry and that we have somehow displeased the gods. And, you know, we would do all sorts of stuff to ceremonies, elaborate ceremonies, and sometimes sacrifices to appease the gods. That was supernatural and paranormal back then, and now we realize it's not. It's just science, earth science. So I would for those people who snicker and kind of raise their eyebrow, I would ask them to just be honest with themselves and before they cast a stone at Bass for having some research facility, which, by the way, they applied the scientific methodology, by the way, rigorously in everything that they do. So even at the ranch, you're looking at the scientific methodology being applied to collect, analyze, and scrutinize. And pretty much that cycle of wash, rinse, and repeat. So these folks aren't dumb. They are top-level scientists, top-shelf scientists, PhDs, theoretical physicists, the best of the best. So I would encourage people, before they make a judgment call on this, to do just a little bit of research, look who was on the staff on Bass at the time, and actually educate themselves on what they were doing. And then at that point, if they want to make the decision that, look, this is kind of far out there, kind of weird, and I don't agree with it, fine. But make an informed decision based upon the facts, and not because you hear the word paranormal, and all of a sudden now, ha, 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 you know, these guys are, you know, Ghostbusters.
The Pentagon, when the New York Times story broke, a spokesperson said the program ended, the money went somewhere else. Why did it end in that capacity? How does it continue, to your knowledge? And did religion play a role in the decision to move the funding around?
Yes. There were some theological grievances against what we were doing. It was told to me, I won't say by who, but by a very senior person, that they knew very well what we were doing was correct. But they didn't believe in what we were doing because they ascribed it to demonic forces. I mean, that's just the bottom line. You know, I wouldn't have believed it myself unless I heard it myself with my own ears. But yeah, and look, in the end, I don't blame people for that. If someone has a religious conviction where they believe that is the case, then look, so be it. I'm okay with that. But let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's go ahead and look at this from a defense perspective. This is something collectively we should be looking at. Why did the funding run out? Because the funding was only approved for 5 years initially. But then what you don't hear is later on we had additional funding that was provided down through Congress from 2013 to 2014. And you don't hear about that. Now, the problem is that the wording was very general, so another office basically took it from my office. It was intended to come to my office, and unfortunately it went to another office. But the program did not end in 2012. The funding for the program for specifically the ATIP may have, but then additional funding was sent to the department in 2013 to 2014, and then from 2014 to 2015 and 16, we had to be a little bit more clever. But Mr. Knapp, please keep in mind, the way it works in DOD, programs don't just disappear and fade off into the sunset, okay? It's like a soldier guarding their post. When you're told to guard your post, you guard your post until you are relieved by a senior officer, period. And for us, those orders never came. We were never told to disestablish and stand down. In fact, we continue to provide information to senior leadership, and they continue to take the information, they continue to listen, we continue to collect, analyze, scrutinize, et cetera. So the program never ended. We were never told to shut down. There was never an order to disestablish.
I guess people wonder, where is all the material? Will it be made public? And is Tom DeLong and To the Stars, your new employer, is what's going to happen there? A lot of questions, but can you give us a general idea about what comes next and when?
Well, I think if you talk about To the Stars Academy of Arts and Science, you have to look at the people. People are the most important aspect of any organization. So this is not, as some had said, some sort of money-making endeavor. In fact, I would submit to you, if you wanted to make money, this is probably the very last option you'd ever want to take. It's incredibly difficult, and it's not really a profitable way for a company per se. But Tom and others decided to do it this way because they thought it was the best way to get people involved. And frankly, I agree. I think, Tom tends to be a bit of a maverick as an artist. And he wanted to give everybody, every person out there, an ability to be part of something with this company. And so he did. He created this by getting some of the very best of the best on his team, excluding me. I wish I was in that category, but I'm certainly not. But let's just go through a real quick roll call of who he has. He's got Jim Simivan, right? He's got the famous Hal Pudoff. He's got Steve Justice from none other than Skunk Works. Like the Skunk Works. These guys are building aircraft and technology we won't see for the next 50 years. Chris Mellon, who, by the way, was one of the most senior people in the department at the time, at some point back in the past with the Department of Defense. You have Gary Nolan. I mean, a Nobel nominee, guys. A Nobel nominee. Dr. Norm Kahn. These are folks that are advising Tom and To the Stars. These are very, very intelligent people. These are very rational people.
Lou, we're about out of time. Just in 10 seconds, are we going to see some more info soon?
I sure hope so. Yeah, that's our intent. And more than information, hopefully we can really bring forward some amazing stuff here. We are very hopeful, and we are working very hard through this DPO to make that happen.
All right, Luis Elizondo, thanks very much. Man, we need more time. We'll have to have you come back. Appreciate it.
Sure. My pleasure.
All right. We got a song taking us into the break called Aliens Exist from back in 1999, a little band called Blink-182. We should have known back then, I guess. We'll be right back with John Greenwald here on Coast to Coast AM.